Last week we saw stories about how Saul's paranoia about David became obsessive to him, so much so that he tried to track David down and hunted him and chased him, wanting to kill him. And through that we continued to see David's faithfulness, David's obedience to God, David's respect and reverence for God's choice of Saul as the king. And although God gave David numerous opportunities to do something about Saul, David didn't take him out of respect and reverence and faithfulness to God and respect for the Lord's anointed. So today we're going to continue on in the story. We're going to cover 11 chapters, 1 Samuel 28 through chapter 7 of 2 Samuel. And we will basically see the culmination of this and the transition to the next king, the second king of Israel, David. David will become king. Okay? So let's pick up in chapter 28 of 1 Samuel. And we see that besides chasing David around, and we saw this a little bit last week, that Saul still had trouble with the Philistines. The Philistines were the big menace. They were the big enemy. They were the big problem. So in those days, we see in chapter 28, verse 4, that the Philistines assembled and came and set up camp at Shunem, while Saul gathered all the Israelites and set up camp at Gilboa. So these are just opposite, just right next to each other, up in the northern area of Israel. When Saul saw the Philistine army, he was afraid. Terror filled his heart. He inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. So the Philistine army gathered and was ready to attack the Israelites. Saul gathered the Israelite troops up in the same region, and before going into battle, he learned his lesson, it seems. He inquired of God. Okay? But verse 6 told us that God didn't answer. Why not? Well, if we go back to chapter 15, we kind of see the last time that God was there to answer him. Verse 10, we see that the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Samuel was troubled and he cried out to the Lord all that night. So what this was the story of when Saul was called by God to go and totally destroy the Amalekites, to devote them to God, kill everyone, kill all the animals, destroy everything. Instead of doing that, Saul went and conquered the Amalekites and killed all the people, except for he kept Agag the king. And instead of killing all the animals, they killed all the crummy ones and kept the good ones. And there you had the excuse that Saul gave. All the men did this so that they could offer offerings. Well, what's more important? Sacrifices or obedience? Obedience is more important. So since Saul did not obey God, we see here that God had rejected him. And then verses 26 through 29 of that chapter, Samuel said to him, and this is after Samuel confronts Saul with it, and Samuel says to Saul, "I will not go back with you. You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel." So God rejected Saul because Saul had rejected God. As Samuel turned to leave, Saul caught the hem of his robe and it tore. Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you." Now he who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he's not a man that he should change his mind. So what God's decided, that's the way it'll be. So God had rejected Saul because Saul had rejected God, and therefore God didn't answer. Now we also see back here when he had inquired of God, what he would do is, inquiring of God involved talking to, you know, the king had the high priest at his disposal, and the high priest had the ephod and used the Urim and Tumim and all of that to inquire of God. Well, Saul had killed the priest of Nob, if you remember from last week, and there was one left, and that was Ahijah, and he was with David, and he had the ephod with David. So that's kind of another point. But the bottom line point is that God did not answer Saul because Saul had rejected God. So since God didn't reply to Saul, how did Saul try to force an answer? Because this is a big battle. The Philistines are coming in mass. Saul's nervous. He's concerned about the situation. So what does he decide to do? Back to chapter 28, verse 7. Saul then said to his attendants, "Find me a woman who's a medium so that I may go and inquire of her." They said, "Well, there's one in Endor." So Saul disguised himself, putting on other clothes, and at night he and two men went to the woman. "Consult a spirit for me," he said, "and bring up for me the one that I name." And the woman asked, "Well, who shall I bring up for you?" "Bring up Samuel," he said. So he, if I can't get an answer out of God, I'm going to go get an answer out of Samuel. The problem is Samuel had died. So he said, "Well, let's go find a medium, someone who can conjure up the dead, and let's see what Samuel has to say, and see if Samuel will give us an answer from God here on before we go into battle." Now, we see that the witch, the medium, was afraid of granting Saul's request. And why is that? Verse 3, we go back to that, and we see that Samuel was dead, and all of Israel had mourned for him and buried him in his hometown of Ramah. Saul had expelled the mediums and spiritists from the land. So Saul, as the king, had put out a command that there would be no mediums or spiritists in the land. So here, Saul was going to a medium, breaking his own rules, and the medium didn't want to be a medium because was very careful about strangers coming in, because there was a rule against it. There was a law against her doing her trade. Well, going on, verse 9, the woman said to him, "Surely you know what Saul's done. He's cut off the mediums and spiritists from the land. Why have you set a trap for my life to bring about my death?" Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As surely as the Lord lives, you will not be punished for this." And then verse 12, after the woman calls up Samuel, she sees him. She cries out at the top of her voice and says to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." Okay, so you see that she recognizes this is Saul now. Well, she brought up Samuel. What does Saul learn from Samuel here? 13 through 19, but we'll start at 15 here. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" "I'm in great distress," Saul said. "The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has turned away from me. He no longer answers me, either by prophets or by dreams. So I've called on you to tell me what to do." Samuel said, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has turned away from you and has become your enemy? The Lord has done what he predicted through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to one of your neighbors, to David." Okay, the one better than you, he had said before. "Because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will hand over both Israel and you to the Philistines. And tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also hand over the army of Israel to the Philistines." Is this the kind of word that Saul wanted to hear? No. Okay. But Israel would lose. A day later, Saul and his sons would all be killed by the Philistines, as well as the army would be conquered by the Philistines. Did Saul believe what he heard? It's not good news. Did he believe it? Verse 20, immediately Saul fell full length on the ground, filled with fear because of Samuel's words. His strength was gone because he had eaten nothing all that day and night. So yes, he knew that Samuel had spoken the truth. He fell on the ground in fear. How well did Saul follow through with his fast? He had been fasting before this. Did he continue his fast? We'll jump to 23 here. The woman tried to offer him food. He refused and said, "I will not eat." But his men joined the woman in urging him, and he listened to them. He got up from the ground, sat on the couch. The woman had a fattened calf at the house, which she butchered at once, took some flour, kneaded it, and baked some bread without yeast. And she set it before Saul and his men, and they ate. That same night they got up and left. So here, even on his last day, he knows he's got his last day. He's fasted before the Lord. Before he saw Samuel, he consulted a spiritist, a medium here, and then when the men encourage him, he eats. Okay, he breaks his fast to God. So he's, like always, he's swayed by others. So where was David during all this time? Okay, the Philistines are mounting, and Saul's got this great battle up in the northern part of Israel. Where's David during these times? Let's go back a chapter, chapter 27. But David thought to himself, one of these days I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I'll slip out of his hand. So we then see in the next verses that David and his men go to Gath, which is one of the big cities of the Philistines. And verse 4, we see that when Saul hears that David fled to Gath, he no longer searched for him. So it accomplished what David was looking for. David makes friends with Achish, who is the king of Gath. And they settle there peacefully and have a nice relationship. And then in verse 5, David asks Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be assigned to me in one of the country towns that I may live there. Why should your servant live in the royal city with you? So on that day, Achish gave him Ziklag, and it's belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in Philistine territory for a year and 4 months. So where was David when all this was happening to Saul, and Saul was getting ready for battle? He was in Philistines. He was in a town in the land of the Philistines outside of Gath. This town called Ziklag. Well, when the Philistines went out to fight the Israelites, what did David and his men do? Well, the first verse of verse 28, it says, in those days the Philistines gathered their forces to fight against Israel. Achish, you know, the king of Gath, said to David, you must understand that you and your men will accompany me in the army. Okay, so by them taking refuge in Philistine territory, they then also had to provide military support and assist their allies, the Philistines. And now the Philistines were going to go fight the Israelites. You know, why did Achish think that David would go through with that? David is, you know, one who has killed tens of thousands of Philistines and all that. Well, if you look back at the end of chapter 27, which we saw last week, we see that while David and his men were in Ziklag, they would go out on raiding parties, and they would go raid other towns of other peoples, not Philistines, but Gerzites and Geshurites and Amalekites, others in the southern part south of Philistia. And whenever Achish would say, hey, where'd you go? He said, oh, I was raiding the towns of the Negev of Judah. In other words, I was raiding the Israelites. So it was clear to Achish that David was Saul's enemy. That's why he had sought refuge. And David, therefore, was an enemy of Israel, and David hated Israel and fought against Israel. And so Achish didn't think twice about asking David, and plus they had become friends, about asking David to come and join in the battle against Israel. And then verse chapter 29, verse 2, we see that as the Philistines were gathering their forces at Aphek, as the Philistine rulers marched with their units of hundreds and thousands, David and his men were marching at the rear with Achish. Okay, so as the Philistines were gathering there to do war against Israel in northern Israel territory at Shunem, David and his men were along with him. Now, why would David and his men do this? What's interesting is 28 verse 2, David said, when Achish told him that you need to come help us, David said, well, then you'll see for yourself what your servant can do. And Achish said, very well, then I'll make you my bodyguard for life. So you see the trust that Achish was putting into him, but you see the kind of double-meaning kind of response that David said here. You'll see for yourself what your servant can do. Okay? So Achish is thinking that David's on his side. David knows whose side he's on. And David's men know that as well. So they go and go to this battle here. So did David and his men end up fighting against the Israelites? Going on chapter 29, and really the whole chapter covers this, but we'll just read a few verses. Starting at verse 9, Achish tells David, I know that you've been as pleasing in my eyes as an angel of God, but nevertheless, the Philistine commanders have said he must not go up with us into battle. In other words, the other Philistine commanders didn't trust him. Achish knew him, but remember, Philistines, there were five major cities, and each city had a king. Well, the other four cities, the commanders and the kings of the other cities, they didn't know David's reputation with Achish, and they didn't care. They didn't trust him. Okay, So, in fact, in verse 5, they say, isn't this the David that they sang about in their dances, that Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? There's no way we're letting him come into battle with us. He can turn on us from inside. No way. So Achish then tells David, now get up early along with your master's servants, this is verse 10, who have come with you, and leave in the morning as soon as it's light. So we see that David and his men were not allowed to stay and fight in the battle because the Philistine commanders were afraid. So David and his men go home. They go back to Ziklag. Now, when they get back to Ziklag, there's a surprise waiting for them. Chapter 30. David and his men reach Ziklag on the third day. Now, the Amalekites, these guys continue to create problems. Saul had wiped out a bunch of them, but there were still some around, and we saw that David, because they were a nomadic kind of group, and there were various groups of Amalekites. The big group, the ones that had settled in cities, or the ones that Saul had destroyed, there were still others around, and David had been raiding them. So that we see that when David was gone, the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag. Okay? They had attacked Ziklag and burned it, and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both young and old. They killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. So you see, while David and his men left Ziklag, it was unprotected, and the Amalekites came in and conquered it and destroyed it, burned it, destroyed the city to the ground, and carried off all the people and all the plunder, all the valuables. So how did David and his men respond to this disaster? So David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. How would you expect they would respond? Their families are gone. Their homes are gone. Their whole livelihoods are gone. Everything that they were, that their lives were their love was based on, besides God, was gone. David was, verse 6, David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. So on top of him being upset about his family being gone, all the men were so upset that they wanted to kill David. And so that upset him even further. But each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. But David found strength in Yahweh his God. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. Abiathar brought it to him, and David inquired of Yahweh, shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them? Pursue them, he answered. You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue. Their response was this great mourning, as you would expect. Then David inquired of God and to see whether he should go, which is interesting because he didn't just go. The obvious thing to do is, you're upset, your family's been taken, besides being very upset and mourning about it, you want to, if you're an army, you go chase those people down and you get your family back. Or you get revenge if they had killed your family or whatever. But he didn't. Instead, he inquired of God first. He didn't just go. And God said, yes, you will have success in this. So were they able to recover their families and belongings? Well, you've got the rest of the story in the rest of that chapter, which I'll let you read on your own, which is some interesting stuff. We'll just read a couple of verses. 17, David fought them from dusk until the evening of the next day, and none of them got away, except for 400 young men who rode off on camels and fled. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken, including his two wives. Nothing was missing, young or old, boy or girl, plunder, or anything else they had taken. David brought everything back. Okay? So they had the victory. There's some interesting stories in there that you might want to look at. They end up finding an Egyptian slave of the Amalekites who had been left behind because he was sick, and he's the one who brought them and showed them where to find the Amalekites. So you have that in the first verses there that we skipped. And then at the end you also have situation there that now that they've got this plunder, 200 out of the 600 men had been too tired, too exhausted to continue on and didn't participate in the battle. They stayed with the supplies. So now that they had all this plunder, the men who had fought said, hey, David, we deserve all the plunder. We'll let the men who stayed behind and didn't participate in the battle, we'll let them have their women and children and have their families, but all the good stuff we keep. And David said, no, they get to share in the plunder just like the ones who fought. And that was set, it says in verse 25, David made this a statute and ordinance for Israel from that day to this. So that was put into cast into place from that point on. Okay, so all this was happening. This is what was happening to David while Saul was facing this battle that would end up being his last battle of his life. Okay, so we've got that little side story there. So let's go back to Saul. Okay, that next day, the day after Saul had visited the medium, is the battle. And Samuel had said Saul would be killed and his sons would be killed. So what happens? Chapter 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the Israelites fled before them, and many fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Okay, so Saul and his army was up on this mountain, which gives them a stronger vantage point from this attacking army having to climb the mountain. The Philistines pressed hard after Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Okay, so the Philistines attacked, and the Philistines had great success and killed many of the soldiers. They killed the princes, Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, and they wounded Saul. Well, what did Saul do to make sure that a Philistine wouldn't kill him? He didn't want a Philistine to kill him. Because they wouldn't just kill him. If they found the king, before killing him, they would make his life miserable. And you see things like that. You know, what happened when they captured Samson? They put out his eyes. They made a laughingstock out of him. You see in other cases when victories were had, that the conquering army would take the king's children and families and execute them before his eyes, and then maybe put his eyes out so the last thing he saw was the last thing he would ever want to see, something he would never want to see. And so he didn't want all that to happen to him. And so what did he do to make sure a Philistine wouldn't kill him? Because he's just injured now, but the Philistines are approaching. Verse 4, Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all of his men died together that same day. So he asked his armor bearer to finish him off. The armor bearer wouldn't do it, wouldn't lift his hand against Saul. So Saul tried to commit suicide there. So why did Saul die like this? Why, and this is kind of for God's anointed, for the one that God had chosen to be king over Israel, the first king of Israel. Why would God allow him to die in such a bad way? Well, if we turn to 1 Chronicles 10, and in fact, at this point, you know, we've been going through Samuel's, and we really haven't looked at the books of 1 Chronicles yet, because really, if you go through 1 Chronicles, starting at chapter 1, and you go through, basically through chapter 9, you've got, that's kind of like the book of Numbers. You've got a bunch of genealogies, and who were the key people in the various tribes and things like that. So you really don't have much in the way of stories. Now we get to 1 Chronicles chapter 10, and this is where 1 Chronicles kind of takes over. In the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, from this time on, we'll start seeing so the same stories repeated in both. 1 Chronicles and 1 Kings, and a lot of times you'll see the exact same verbiage. And so whether Chronicles, and the thought is that Chronicles drew from 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. And you'll kind of see that. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings is focused on the entire nation of Israel. And when the nation of Israel divides, which we'll see in a few weeks, 1 and 2 Kings is also concerned with the northern tribe as well as the southern tribe. Whereas 1 and 2 Chronicles is focused mainly on the southern tribe, the tribe of Judah. And now that we have David coming into power, that's where 1 Chronicles takes over. It really doesn't give any time to Saul, In fact, the only thing story it really has about Saul is what we have right now in chapter 10 is the same story that we have in 1 Samuel chapter 31, and that is the death of Saul, which really is just setting the stage for David to take over, which we'll see. So, back to the question, why did God allow Saul to die like this? Well, 1 Chronicles 10, verse 13, Saul died because he was unfaithful to the Lord. He did not keep the word of the Lord and even consulted a medium for guidance. And he did not inquire of the Lord. So the Lord put him to death and turned the kingdom over to David, son of Jesse. So why did God let his anointed die like this? Because he had been an unfaithful king. So God gave the king over to one who would be faithful, and that is David. All right, what was the outcome of this battle for Israel? We see the outcome for Saul and his sons. What about for Israel? Verse 7. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan, saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned their towns and fled. And the Philistines came and occupied them. So the people who were living close to where this battle was taking place, they feared the Philistines. They knew the Philistines would come now that the king had been killed, the army had been decimated. Then the towns are fair game. And sure enough, the Philistines went to those towns, but the people had left the towns, and the Philistines just occupied them. They didn't even have to conquer them. So what we're seeing here is that the Philistines gain control and take over a big part of Israelite territory here. So a big, big loss for Israel. How did the Philistines respond to the news that Saul was dead? Verse 8, the next day when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put his armor in the temple of the Asherahs, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. So what did they do? Well, this was common when you had a big victory like this. You would display your victory. And just as when they took when they captured the ark, we saw earlier in 1 Samuel, they took it and put it in the temple of Dagon, showing that their god Dagon was more powerful than the Israelite god Yahweh. And you remember the story of what happened there. So here they take the king of the Israelites and they take his body and show that we are more powerful and we've had victory over him, and they hang it up as a billboard. Okay. We see then that the men of Jabesh-Gilead do something out of respect for Saul. Verse 11. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all of their valiant men journeyed through the night to Bethshan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. So you see that when they heard what had happened, and they heard that Saul's body was hung up on the wall at Bethshan, they traveled through the night, long journey, and they traveled and went to Bethshan, and they took Saul's body down, as well as those of his sons, took him back to Jabesh-Gilead, and there they burned him. Cremation was not something that the Israelites normally did, so why would they burn him? Well, because if they only buried the bodies, then the Philistines could come dig them back up and post them on the wall again and do whatever else. So by burning them, that prevents the Philistines from continuing to abuse Saul's body. Okay, why did they do that? Why did they have such strong concern for Saul? Well, if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 11, you see soon after Saul was anointed king and appointed king and accepted as or presented before the Israelites as king. Well, what did he do? He went back to farming. But while he was farming, we see in 1 Samuel chapter 11 that Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. So Jabesh-Gilead had been under attack by the Ammonites. So word then got to Saul about what had happened to Jabesh-Gilead while he was coming in from the field. And in verse 6, when the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and reported these terms to the people, they all wept aloud. Just then Saul was returning from the field, and when Saul heard their words, verse 6, the Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he burned with anger. Then he mustered up the the Israelites in an army at Bezek, and the men of Israel numbered 300,000, the men of Judah 30,000. And then we see that the next day, verse 11, Saul separated his men into three divisions during the last watch of the night. They broke into the camp of the Ammonites and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. And then as a result of that, in verse 15, all the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. So Jabesh-Gilead, why did they have such great concern over Saul and protect his body like that? Because Saul was their hero. Saul was the reason they still existed, that they were still there, that they had not been destroyed by the Ammonites. There was a great love between the men of Jabesh-Gilead and Saul, and that's why they reacted like that. Okay, now Saul is dead. Saul is gone, and it's now time for David to be king, right? And that's why we now have this move from 1 Samuel to 2 Samuel, and that's your break point. So that's an easy thing to remember, is that the story of 1 Samuel, the stories that we have there, begin basically with the story of Samuel, and then end with the completion of Saul. And then we start 2 Samuel with the beginning of the story of David. And really, if you kind of look at it, it ends with the story of David. So really, all the rest of the book of 2 Samuel is all the story of David. And then 1 Kings starts with Solomon, and then we go on from there. Now, to be honest, the book of Samuel had originally been one book. There's one book of Samuel, but I guess it was too big for the scrolls or something, so they divided it into two, and that's why we have the 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. So what we have in 1 Samuel 1 is just a continuation of the story that just finished in 31 verse 13. It's, you know, when this was written, it was not written as, okay, now we finish this book and we start this book. It was one continuous story. So let's go on. 2 Samuel chapter 1. How does David learn of Saul's death? Verse 1, after the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed in Ziklag for 2 days. On the third day, at this time he doesn't know about Saul's death. Okay, he defeated the Amalekites and he goes back to Ziklag. He's there for a couple of days, even though the town's pretty destroyed, but that's where they're staying. On the third day, a man arrived from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. When he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid him honor. "Where have you come from?" David asked him. He answered, "I've escaped from the Israelite camp." "What happened?" David said. "Tell me." Because David knew about this battle, because he had marched, he had been there. He had gone there to fight in this battle against the Philistines, although Achish, the Philistine king, had thought it was going to be with them. "So what happened?" David asked. "Tell me." The man said, "The men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died, and Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead?" "I happened to be on Mount Gilboa," the young man said, "and there was Saul, leaning on his spear with the chariots and riders almost upon him. Then he turned around and saw me, and he called out to me, and I said, 'What can I do?' He asked me, 'Well, who are you?' 'An Amalekite,' I answered. Then he said to me, 'Stand over me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, but I'm still alive.' So I stood over him and I killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he couldn't survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord." So how did this man know that Saul was dead? Because I killed him. Okay, said that he killed Saul. Why did he say that? Well, David is obviously going to be the next king. Everyone knows that. Hey, how better to win favor with the new king by to show him that he can now be king, and the enemy who's been pursuing him and trying to kill him is dead. And you know what? I had a part in that. I did the killing. So he's looking to win favor, and he brings the crown, he brings the armband to give him proof, and says, "Here, this crown is now yours." So he thinks that great accolades, and you know, David's going to be thrilled about this. So how does David respond to the news that this man brought to him, that the man who was trying to kill him was gone, that had died. Verse 11. Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. Okay, which you never do. That's a sign of deep mourning. Clothes were too expensive to do that with. They mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. So they were, David and his men were deeply saddened. So you see, it's not just David. His men had picked up from David this love and respect and reverence for God's anointed. And so when Saul had died, this is their king. This is the king of Israel. David and his men were running from Saul because Saul was kind of out of his mind, but they weren't trying to kill Saul. They had respect for Saul. And so you see that they all mourned and were deeply saddened, and they wept and they fasted. How else did David respond? Verse 17. David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow, as it's written in the book of Jashar. And goes on and sings this lament about this battle, about this loss, about the loss of life. Like verse 23, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious, and in death they were not parted. And then, of course, especially about Jonathan, verse 25, how the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your hearts. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You are very dear to me. So we see that he writes this poet. David is a poet. We've got a whole book of songs that he wrote, the book of Psalms. He wrote most of those. And he writes a poem. And in fact, later on when he becomes king over Judah, he requires that the men of Judah learn this lament and learn this song. All right, this man who had killed Saul and brought the word to David, how was he rewarded for his bringing the kingship to David? Verse 13. David said to the young man who brought him the report, "Where are you from?" "I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite," he answered. Well, who had David just been fighting? Amalekites. But that's not the reason David is going to react about this. David asked him, "Well, then, why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called down one of his men and said, "Go strike him down." So he struck him down and he died. For David had said to him, "Your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, 'I killed the Lord's anointed.'" Okay. So even though Saul was dying, even though Saul's death was imminent, it was still not up to one of God's people to take the life of the Lord's anointed. Okay. And that was a position that David took here, and you see his reaction. So his reaction is totally opposite of what this man expected, what others might expect David to respond. The normal human reaction of someone who's going to be the next king is, all right, the king is dead. In fact, in those days, they would kill everybody who supported the old king to make sure that there was no threat. But David wasn't claiming the kingship himself. He was accepting what God was going to give him. So why did David respond this way? And we see some of this back in what we've covered in the past. We covered last week. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 24, we see in verses 5 and 6, afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he's the anointed of the Lord." So even when David, he had the opportunity to kill Saul there in that cave when Saul was relieving himself, but he didn't. But he cut off a piece of Saul's robe, and that bothered David that he had done that. How could I even think of cutting off part of the robe of the Lord's anointed? So you see the feeling that he's got there. Chapter 26, we see he gets another chance to kill Saul. Starting at verse 9, and this is David and Abishai go into the camp, and Saul and the soldiers and all are sleeping. And David says to Abishai, "Don't destroy him." Okay, because in verse 8, Abishai says, "Today God's delivered your enemy into your hands. Let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't have to strike him twice." David said, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives, the Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he'll die, or he'll go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go." So David's concept here is, if God wants him dead, God will get him dead. It's not me to, it's not my place to decide. It's not in anyone's place to decide to assassinate the Lord's anointed. Okay? And then, you see how he even brings this out later. When he has the spear and the water jug, he then shouts to Abner, who's the commander of Saul's army, who's responsible for protecting Saul. And verse 16, he says to Abner, "What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die, because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and the water jug that were near his head?" And he holds them up and shows them where they are. So here he reprimands and rebukes Abner for not guarding the Lord's anointed. Okay, and again shows his love for and respect for Saul as being the Lord's anointed. There's another thing that we see that David does in response to news about the demise of Saul. That is, you know, what we talked about with the men of Jabesh-Gilead and how they went and took care of Saul's body. What did David, how did he respond to them for what they did? Chapter 2, second half of verse 4. "When David was told that it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, 'The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them.'" So he praised the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Now you see a lot of political strength in what he's doing here. But in those days, you know, Jabesh-Gilead standing up in support of Saul is taking a position that puts them in potential opposition to this next king. And David instead praises them for that. So he makes this relationship here. So you see the political nature of it, but what you really see is, again, David's feeling towards the Lord's anointed, that God had chosen Saul, and people should support who God puts into place, which fits with what we see that Paul talks a lot about, and Jesus talks a lot about, give to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God's. You know, Peter talks about it, that God has put these our governments into place, and we're to respect them and to obey them as if we were respecting and obeying God. And David understood that. Okay, where is David at this time? He's in Philistine territory. Remember, he's at Ziklag. That's where he is. So does he then, now that it's safe and Saul's not going to kill him, why is he in Philistine territory? Because Saul was pursuing him and he went to Philistine territory so that Saul would stop pursuing him. Well, now that Saul's not going to pursue him anymore, does he then go back to Israel? 2 Samuel chapter 2. "In the course of time..." Okay, so in other words, he didn't right away. "But in the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?' he asked. The Lord said, 'Go up.' David asked, 'Well, where should I go?' 'To Hebron,' the Lord answered." The obvious thing for someone who has their heart set on becoming the next king is, as soon as the first king is dead, you jump into place right away. If you wait time, someone else is going to jump into place and you'll lose your opportunity, or you may have a battle on your hands to claim that kingship. But you see, David's not trying to claim the kingship. He's just trying to follow God. And if God wants him to be king, God will make him king, and David doesn't have to take it by force. So David waits time, it says here. And then before he goes, he asks God, "Should I go?" Well, it's obvious he should go, but no, it's not, because he asked God. And God says, "Yes, and go to Hebron." God even tells him where to go. Hebron is, it's been around a long time. We've seen it since the book of Genesis. Very ancient town there in the southern tribe of Judah. Okay? And then what happens when he gets there? Verse 3, "David also took with him the men who were with him, and each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah." So now we see that the southern tribe accepts David, and they anoint him king over the southern tribe. Now we have a king over a tribe instead of, you know, so far we've had one king of Israel, and he was king over all of Israel. Well, there's 12 tribes, and David becomes a king over one of the tribes of Judah. Actually, probably over two of the tribes, because Judah, right in the middle of Judah, was a tribe of Simeon. And so when they talk about the tribe of Judah, they usually talk about Judah and Simeon together. So we'll you'll see as we go on, it talks about Judah being a tribe, and then the other 10 tribes. Okay, and that's why 10 plus 1 does equal 12. Okay. So he was made king over the southern tribe. Why not all of Israel? Going on, verse 8. Meanwhile, Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, son of Saul. So Saul had a fourth son named Ishbosheth, and brought him over to Mahanaim. Mahanaim is over on the eastern side of the Jordan River, a place that where the Philistines really wouldn't be. This isn't in the heart of Israel, because the Philistines have taken some of those towns, and the Philistines are strong in the heart of Israel. So he goes to Mahanaim, and there he makes Ishbosheth king over Gilead, which is the eastern side, Ashuri and Jezreel there in the north, and also over Ephraim, Benjamin, and all of Israel. Okay, so in other words, he makes him king over the other 10 tribes, over the rest of Israel. So he makes him king over Israel. It's just that Judah had already made making David king over Judah. So now we see a separation between Judah and the northern tribes. Now, who was Abner? Abner was, you see in your note, Ner was his dad, and Ner was Saul's uncle. If you look at 1 Samuel 14, verse 50, you see that Ner was Saul's uncle, and Abner was Saul's cousin. And Saul had put him as, set him up as the commander of his army. So Abner was the commander of the army. Now that Saul was gone, he's kind of the most he's the most powerful guy. So he then makes Ishbosheth king in Saul's place. Well, you've now got two kings over Israel. What do you expect to happen here? Well, the two armies, the army of Israel, the army of Judah, they meet at Gibeon. We'll see that. Chapter 2, verse 12. Abner, the son of Ner, together with the men of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, left Mahanaim and went to Gibeon. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, Joab, we'll see, this is the first time we see him, and we'll see a whole lot more about Joab. He ends up becoming the commander of David's army. But Joab, son of Zeruiah, and David's men went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. One group sat down on one side of the pool, and one group on the other side. Okay, so we've got this battle about to happen here. And then, you know, if you remember back to the story of David and Goliath, Goliath was saying, hey, rather than us having all this bloodshed, since the kings decide, since the gods decide who wins battles, let's just have your best men against me, and whoever wins between the two of us wins the battle, okay, so instead of having the armies fight together. So they do the same sort of thing here. In verse 13, we see that Abner says to Joab, let's just have some of the young men get up and fight hand-to-hand in front of us. All right, let them do that, Joab said. So you see, Abner and Joab were able to talk, even though they were kind of enemies here. And, you know, by these men getting up and fighting, that will kind of decide really who is in charge here, who's in charge of Israel. Skipping down to, we see in verses 15 and 16 that they fight and they kill each other. So they team off, 12 men for Benjamin and 12 for David. Or 12 for Israel and 12 for David, Judah. And they fight each other and they all die. So 24 of them die. So there's no victor there. So then the armies start fighting. In verse 17, the battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the men of Israel were defeated by David's men. Okay, so David, his men got the upper hand. Going on to verse 30, then Joab returned from pursuing Abner and assembled all of his men. Besides Asahel, 19 of David's men were found missing. But David's men had killed 360 Benjamites who were with Abner. So there we have Judah, David's side, wins the battle. And only 19 of David's men were found dead, including the 12 that had fought the hand-to-hand, so that's only seven who had died in battle versus hundreds of the Israelites. Now, in those verses that we skipped there, you also have a little story where Joab's brother, he had two brothers, Abishai and Asahel, and Asahel pursued Abner. During this battle, he was chasing Abner, and Abner said, "Stop chasing me, okay? I don't want to fight you. We've got the battles fighting. I need to be able to speak with your brother Joab, and don't make me kill you, because that's going to get Joab upset, and it's going to ruin our relations to be able to settle this in a better way." But Asahel keeps chasing him, so Abner, meaning to just kind of knock him out and stop him, he takes the back end of his sword, not the front end of his sword where the sword is, but the back end, the staff, and hits Asahai in the stomach with it. Well, it goes all the way through him, and it kills Asahai. So Asahai dies here. Okay, so that's a story that you need to hear about, because you'll see results of that as we go on. So was this the only battle between the houses of Saul and the house of David? Chapter 3, verse 1, the war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. So it lasted a number of years, or a long time. David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. Okay, so you see the results of it, this civil war that's going on here. Well, what happened that turned Abner's support away from Ishbosheth? Okay, verse 6, chapter 3. During the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now, Saul had a concubine named Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why did you sleep with my father's concubine?" Now, by doing that, by sleeping with Saul's concubine, Saul's mistress, that is stating claim that I own this, that I'm laying claim to Saul's kingship, is really what that's kind of saying. And so Ishbosheth accuses Abner of doing this. Abner's response, verse 8, Abner was very angry because of what Ishbosheth had said, and he answered, "Am I a dog's head on Judah's side? This very day I am loyal to the house of your father Saul, and to his family and his friends. I have not handed you over to David, yet now you accuse me of an offense involving this woman?" Okay, so he's offended by this. He did not sleep with that woman. Ishbosheth had accused him of that, and he takes offense to that. "I have been the most loyal person to your father that I could ever be, and now you make this accusation like this. I've had many opportunities to turn you and the kingdom over to David, and I have not done that." So what does he decide to do in response to this accusation? Verse 9, "May God deal with Abner, be it ever so severely, if I do not do for David what the Lord promised him on oath, and transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and establish David's throne over Israel and Judah, from Dan to Beersheba." Dan is way in the north, Beersheba's way in the south. Ishbosheth did not dare to say another word to Abner because he was afraid of him. "Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't." Of course, you should not have, Ishbosheth. This really, set some things in motion that were not returnable here. So, did Abner follow through with his intentions? Going on, verse 17, "Abner conferred with the elders of Israel and said, 'For some time you've wanted to make David your king.'" Okay, so the elders, the leaders of the tribes of Israel, they thought, "Well, you know, we probably shouldn't have made Ishbosheth king. We should have made David king, like the men of Judah." And he says, "Okay, you've wanted to do this. Now do it." Okay, Abner's the one who's kind of stopping him. "Now do it. For the Lord promised David, 'By my servant David, I will rescue my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hands of all their enemies.'" Philistines are still a big problem. They've got a lot of the territory of Israel, and God had promised to rescue Israel from the Philistines, or that's the word that they understood. And so he goes to them and says, "Do it." Abner also spoke to the Benjamites in person. He then went to Hebron to tell David everything that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin wanted to do. So he speaks with Israel's elders, and then he goes to tell David. Now he had, we skipped a few verses there, that he had sent messengers to David and about making an agreement to bring all of Israel over to him. So he is being a traitor to Ishbosheth, but he's really kind of the one in control of the northern tribes, and he wants to bring it over to David. Well, let's go back. Those verses I did skip. I do have a thing here. What did David want before he would meet with Abner? Verse 13. David said, "I'll make an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal, the daughter of Saul, when you come to see me." Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, son of Saul, demanding, "Give me my wife Michal, who I betrothed to myself for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins." So Ishbosheth gave orders and had her taken away from her husband Paltiel, son of Laish. Her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go back home." So he went back home. Michal, why did he steal Michal from her husband? Well, she had already been stolen from her husband. Her husband was David. David had married, this was his first wife. This is the wife that Saul's daughter that he had given to David in marriage for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins, if you remember that story a few weeks ago. And David had actually killed 200 Philistines to do that. And Saul, when David fled, Saul ended up giving her to another man. David wanted his wife back. Okay, and so he got her back here. Which, this is part of Saul's household here too. So there's a political thing here too, to where he has the daughter of Saul. So again, kind of making amends. Part of what you'll see David doing here, even though he does it out of love for God, there's a lot of political reasons that grease the skids and make it easier for all of Israel to accept him as the king rather than a conquering king that came in and destroyed and killed their king and took over the kingdom from their king and therefore leaving enemies within his area. So, alright, how did David respond to this visit from Abner, the commander of Saul's army? Verse 20. When Abner, who had 20 men with him, came to David at Hebron, David prepared a feast for him and his men. Then Abner said to David, "Let me go at once and assemble all of Israel for my lord the king, so that they may make a compact with you, and that you may rule over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Okay, so he openly accepted Abner, gave him a feast, talked with him, and then sent him away peacefully. Okay, this is the commander of the army that you're in a civil war against. Okay, but David saw God's hand at work here. Well, Joab, meanwhile, was out fighting another battle, and when he came back in, how did he respond to what David, how David had handled Abner? Verse 24. Joab went to the king and said, "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he's gone. You know Abner, son of Ner. He came to deceive you and observe your movements and to find out everything you're doing. He came to spy on you, and you let him, and you let him go. How could you do that?" So he was very upset that Abner had been allowed to come and go. Was he really concerned about Abner coming to spy? Well, let's see. Let's go on. How does Joab handle this threat that he feels from Abner? Verse 26. Joab then left David and sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sirah. And he came back because he's in a peaceful situation with David right now. But David did not know it. Now when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the gateway as though to speak with him privately. And there, to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel, Joab stabbed him in the stomach and he died. So Joab's concern about Abner coming, he wants Abner dead, not because Abner's a commander of the army that he's fighting against in the Civil War, not because he thought Abner had come to spy on David, but rather he wants revenge for his brother's death. Okay? So he kills him. He kills Abner here. How does David respond to this? Verse 28. Later, when David heard about this, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever innocent before the Lord concerning the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May his blood fall upon the head of Joab and upon all of his father's house. May Joab's house never be without someone who has a running sore or leprosy or leans on a crutch or falls by the sword or who lacks food. Okay. Joab and his brother Abishai murdered Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel in the battle of Gibeon. That's just a side note that we already looked at. Then David said to Joab and all the people with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and walk in mourning in front of Abner. King David himself walked behind the bier. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb. All the people wept also, and the king sang a lament, and all the people wept over him again. Then they all came and urged David to eat something while it was still day, but David took an oath saying, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun sets. Okay? So David's response was, this is awful. Okay? And he was very upset with Joab about it. And he claimed innocence, saying, I had nothing to do with this. This is entirely Joab's doing. May God curse Joab and his family from this day forward because of what he's done. And he very visibly mourns in front of the people, and he commands others to mourn for the loss of Abner. In fact, he commands Joab and his brother to mourn the loss of Abner. Okay? And he fasted. Well, did the people, when they saw David acting like this, did they believe that David was really innocent, or did they believe that he was just acting? Verse 36. All the people took note and were pleased. Indeed, everything the king did pleased them. So on the day, all the people and all of Israel knew that the king had no part in the murder of Abner, the son of Ner. So they believed him. They saw and they knew that David was innocent. The people were pleased. Well, you see, he stood up and he said, this isn't my doing. This is Joab's doing, and Joab should be cursed for this. Well, what did he do in punishment to Joab? He didn't. Why not? Why didn't he punish Joab and have him executed? Or something. Verse 38. Then the king said to his men, do you not realize that a prince and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am the anointed king, I'm weak, and these sons of Zeruiah are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds. Okay? Joab, his dad was Zeruiah. So Joab and his brother were too strong for David. And David knew that if he tried to execute Joab, he'd have a civil war within his own force, and the army could bend on him because they were loyal to Joab. So he said, although I'm the anointed king, this guy's too powerful for me, and I can't do anything about it, so I'm going to leave it in God's hands and let God deal with him. Joab's too strong for me, but he's not too strong for the Lord. All right, well, Abner's dead. Okay, Ishbosheth is still king over the northern tribes of Israel. What happens to Ishbosheth? Chapter 4, going to verse 5. Now Rechab and Baanah, the sons of Ramon the Beerothite, set out for the house of Ishbosheth, and they arrived there in the heat of the day while he was taking his noonday rest. They went into the inner part of the house as if to get some wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and his brother Baanah slipped away. Okay. Now we see back in verse 2 that Rechab and Baanah were a couple of men who led raiding bands, led raiding parties. So these are men of violence, men of battle. And so they go and they assassinate Ishbosheth. Okay. How does David respond to this? Well, what do you think? How has he responded to the death of Saul? How has he responded to the death of Abner? Again, he sees that, you know, who's in control of the situation? God is. It's not in my hands, it's not in humans' hands to go and control the time that God makes me king. God said he's going to do it, I'll let him do it, I'll put it all in his hands. Now he hears that Rechab and Baanah have killed Ishbosheth, so how does he respond? We'll start at verse 8. And we see that Rechab and Baanah brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who tried to take your life. This is the day the Lord has avenged my lord the king against Saul and his offspring. So you see, they're just as misguided as the others have been about, oh, we're going to get rewarded for making David king over all of Israel now. Well, in verse 9, David answered Rechab and his brother Baanah, the sons of Ramon the Beerite, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of all trouble, when a man told me that Saul is dead and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and I put him to death in Ziklag. That was a reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed, should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you?" So David gave an order to his men, and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet, the hands that had killed Ishbosheth, the feet that had run bringing the news to David, and hung the bodies by the pool in Hebron. Okay, again, displaying them as a sign of David's response to this. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb at Hebron. So you see David's response there. He had them killed, put their bodies on display, buried Ishbosheth. Okay, not the typical kind of thing you would expect to see of someone who's taking over the kingship from a previous king. But then again, David is leaving this in God's hands and is opposed to people putting their own, taking it into their own hands. All right, there's one more member of Saul's family that we know about that's around. We'll jump ahead to chapter 9 and see how David deals with him. Chapter 9, in fact, I'll start the chapter. David asks, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Again, now this isn't necessarily for Saul's sake, but for Jonathan's sake, okay, his best friend ever. So there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. So he called Ziba, and the king asked him, "Is there no one left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" Ziba answered the king. Now, Ziba could have been nervous here, too, because he was a servant of Saul, okay, and this is the new king. So Ziba's kind of walking on pins and needles here. He said, "Well, there's still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked, and he told him. And so David had him brought there. His name was Mephibosheth. And when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth, your servant," he replied. David said, "Don't be afraid, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I'll restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." So he finds out there is one more member of Saul's family, and it happens to be Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. And he really can't care for himself. He's crippled. And so he calls him and says, "I'll take care of you. You can eat at my table for the rest of your life. You're part of my family. You're part of my household, just as I was part of your grandfather's household. And I'm doing this for the sake of your father, Jonathan. And besides, even though I, as king, own all the property that your family owned, that your dad owned, I give it to you." Okay? So that stays in the family, that stays with you, and Ziba, your servant, and all of his families will work that land and provide for you and take care of you, even though I'm taking care of you as well. Okay? So he shows his kindness to Jonathan and Saul's household here. Now, if you look back at 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4, we see why Mephibosheth was crippled. It says, verse 4, "Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell, and he became crippled. His name was Mephibosheth." So when his dad had died, when word came, the nurse dropped him and his legs were broken, and you know, without the medical technology that we have today, he was unable to walk from then on for the rest of his life. Okay, well, Ishbosheth is now dead. The northern tribes do no longer have a king, so where do they turn now that their king was killed? Chapter 5, 2 Samuel. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We're your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you'll become their ruler." When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, The king made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. Okay? So after Ishbosheth had died, the elders of the tribes of Israel came and said, we want you to be our king too. And they made him king, and he made an agreement with them. And we see in verse 4 that he was 30 years old when he became king over all of Israel. And he reigned 40 years till he was 70. Okay, he was there in Hebron for 7 years and 6 months, and then we'll see that he moved to Jerusalem, which is our next part of our story, for 33 years. Okay, so he's now king over all of Israel, but he's based there in Hebron. Hebron is in Judah. Well, if he's supposed to be king over Israel, you don't want to be focused on one particular part. You need to show that you're over all of Israel. Here in America, we have Washington, D.C., which isn't part of any state. Okay, that's on purpose, so that no one state is getting more attention than any of the other states. And so where does David find a neutral place to rule rather than Hebron here in Judah? Going on, verse 6. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, you won't get in here. Even the blind and the lame will ward you off. He thought, David can't get in here. Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. Okay. So where? Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not in any tribe. Jerusalem was on the border between Judah and Benjamin. And neither Judah nor Benjamin claimed it, and that's why the Jebusites were living there. It had been claimed back in the time of Joshua, but also in the time of Joshua, it had been taken back over by the Jebusites, which were a Canaanite group of people. And so David went and conquered it, and moved there. Okay, that became known as the city of David. How did David establish the political capital in Jerusalem then? Verse 9. David then took up residence in the fortress and called it the city of David. He built up the area around it from the supporting terraces inward, and he became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David along with cedar logs and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel and exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people, Israel. He moved into Jerusalem and set up his... Well, he built a palace there. This thing of Hiram, king of Tyre, that's up in Lebanon today. And you'll hear about the cedars of Lebanon, and that's where some craftsmen were, and that's where some great trees were. Judah was pretty mountainous, or Israel was mountainous, and not a whole lot of trees. There were some forests, but the big forests and the great trees that you build things with and the cedars were up by Tyre. And so we see that Hiram, the king of Tyre, supports David. So he makes allies here with Tyre. Was David safe in this fortress of Jerusalem? Jerusalem, you know, the reason the Jebusites didn't think that David would be able to conquer Jerusalem is that it's surrounded by cliffs, okay? And it's got these big, deep valleys and cliffs on three sides of it. So it's a big fortress. So was David... But the Jebusites weren't safe there. Was David safe there? Verse 17. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him. But David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. The thought is this is one of the strongholds where he had stayed when he was fleeing from Saul, probably down, you know, in the desert to the Negev, maybe in Gedi. That's kind of a key place that he spent a fair amount of time, not, you know, right there by the Dead Sea. So he fled to a stronghold when the Philistines came after him. And then what happened? Verse 19. David inquired of the Lord, shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me? The Lord answered, go. For I will surely hand the Philistines over to you. Okay, so he inquired of God. God gave him victory, and if you look at the stories there, you see that he gave him victory twice. He went and he fought the Philistines and conquered them there. And then later in verse 22, the Philistines came and again came to the Valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord said, well, yeah, go, but don't go straight up. Instead, circle around behind him and attack him. And what's neat is verse 24. It says, as soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, move quickly, because that will mean the Lord has gone out in front of you to strike the Philistine army. Okay? Again, the battle is the Lord's, the victory is the Lord's, and David knew that. And David received victory against the Philistines twice here. And through that was also able to recapture some of the towns and territory that the Philistines had taken from Israel. Okay, and so it was bringing peace to his land again. So David established the political capital in Jerusalem, this place that's on the border in a neutral area between Judah and the rest of Israel. Well, what about the religious capital? What did he want to do to establish the religious capital in Jerusalem? We've seen that the religious capital had been in various places where the high priest was. You know, the ark right now is still in somebody else's house. So what did he decide to do? We go to 1 Chronicles 13. We see this in 2 Samuel 6, but 1 Chronicles 13 tells us a few additional things. We'll go to verse 2. He confers with his officers and commanders, and he says, and the whole assembly of Israel, and says, if it seems good to you, and if it's the will of the Lord our God, then let's send word far and wide to the rest of our brothers throughout the territory of Israel, and also the priests and Levites who are with them in their towns and pasture lands, to come and join us, and let's go get the ark of our God and bring it back to us, for it's never been inquired of during the reign of Saul. The whole assembly agreed to do this because it seemed right to the people, so they assembled the Israelites and to go get the ark at Kiriath-Jearim. Then they moved the ark of God from Abinadab's house. That's where it was staying. It was in Abinadab's house there in Kiriath-Jearim on a new cart. They built a brand new cart just for this, with Uzzah and Ahio, which were sons of Abinadab, guiding it. David and all the Israelites were celebrating with all their might before God with songs and their harps and lyres and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. Okay, so great celebration. He went to go get the ark. He called Israel to join him, and all of Israel came together. Again, this is not a David thing. This is not a Judah thing. This is an Israel thing. So they go to get the ark and bring it from Kiriath-Jearim to take it to Jerusalem. But something happens en route. We see this both in the Chronicles and Samuel. We'll just go back to the Samuel verses. Verse 6, when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah, a son of Abinadab there, reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen had stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act of touching the ark. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died beside the ark of God. Okay? So Uzzah touched the ark, did it, you know, he's trying to protect the ark, keep it from falling off, and God struck him down because of irreverently touching the ark. Okay? The ark was never to be touched. Remember when the ark was brought back from the Philistines, some of the men looked inside, and those men were all killed because of their irreverent act. The ark was set up with rings on the sides through which poles were to go, and the ark was to be carried that way. So you never touched the ark, you just put poles through those rings and picked it up to move it. But here he touched it. How did David respond to this incident? Verse 9. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Okay, so David was afraid. He goes, "Oh, what am I doing? I'm maybe overstepping my bounds bringing the ark here. And it's too dangerous. Just look what it did to Uzzah. I shouldn't bring it to me in Jerusalem." Well, later on, he decides to go get the ark. We see that in 1 Chronicles 15. We also see it continuing here, but going on, 1 Chronicles 15. After David had constructed buildings for himself in the city of David, he prepared a place for the ark of God and pitched a tent for it there in Jerusalem. Then David said, "Now, no one but the Levites can carry the ark of God. Okay, no Abinadab's sons or anything like that, because the Lord chose them to carry the ark of the Lord and to minister before him forever." Okay, so we're going to do it right this time. Verse 13, "It was because you, the Levites, did not bring it up in the first time that the Lord our God broke out in anger against us. We did not inquire of him about how to do it." He inquired of God on whether to do it, but he said, we did not inquire of God of how to do it in the prescribed way. So the priests and Levites consecrated themselves in order to bring up the Ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, and the Levites carried the Ark of God with the poles on their shoulders, as Moses had commanded, in accordance with the word of the Lord. Okay, he said, okay, we're going to do it right this time. Let's inquire of God, how are we to do this? And they went and they did it the right way this time, with the poles, rather than on a new cart, the priests carrying it with the poles, and do it that way. Okay, he also pinched a tent where the ark would go there in Jerusalem. So how did this procession go? Chapter 6, verse 13. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. So you see his response of sacrifice. Okay, now that this is underway, we sacrifice to God. Then David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all of his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. Okay, so everyone, including David, danced and celebrated this this great event of bringing the ark to Jerusalem. Okay, now as David comes in and he's dancing before the Lord with all his might, how does his wife Michal, Saul's daughter, react to that? We'll jump to verse 16. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. And then verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me, rather than your father or anyone else in his house, when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I'll be humiliated in my own eyes, but by these slave girls you spoke of, I'll be held in high honor." Okay, and then Michal had no children to the day of her death. So she despised David for acting undignified. "You're the king." Okay, she grew up in the house of the king. "You're the king. You're not supposed to go around dancing and acting like a stupid idiot and letting all the people see you act that way. That's not the way for a king to act." He goes, "Hey, I'll act even stupider if it's something that I'm giving praise to God for." Okay, and so you see the sarcasm in both of their comments there. Well, what did David do once the ark arrived in Jerusalem? Verse 17, they brought the ark of the Lord, and they set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. So the ark arrived in Jerusalem. He put it in the tent of tabernacle, offered sacrifices, and gave gifts to the people who had participated. Okay, great celebration, great celebration. He also wrote a song of praise. If you look at 1 Chronicles 16, you'll see the biggest part of that chapter is this song of praise that he wrote and sang, celebrating the coming of the ark to Jerusalem. So now we have Jerusalem, this city in this fortified city in neutral area between Judah and the northern tribes, and that is now the political kingdom, and it's now the religious, or the political capital, and it's now also the religious capital. Okay? Does something seem strange to you here, though? Here, he's built homes and buildings for himself and for his officials and for his government. He's got this great palace that's built out of cedar logs from Tyre and very ornate. Where's the ark? It's in a tent. Okay? Why didn't he build a temple instead of just a tent? Well, chapter 7. After the king had settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from his enemies all around him, he said to Nathan the prophet, this is the first time we see Nathan's mentioned here too, "Here I am, living in a palace of cedar while the ark of God remains in a tent." Nathan replied to the king, "Whatever you have in mind, go ahead and do it, for the Lord is with you." So David had the same question. Why should the ark? Why should God not have a home, a temple? Okay? But before he does it, he inquires of God, right? He goes to Nathan the prophet and says, you know, it seems wrong that God's in a tent and I'm in this nice palace. And Nathan says, whatever you're thinking of, do it, because God's with you. Okay? Well, but if you know the story, David did not build a temple. Why not? Nathan here says it's okay. Well, going on, verse 4. That night the word of the Lord came to Nathan saying, go and tell my servant David, this is what the Lord says. Are you the one to build me a house to dwell in? I've not dwelt in a house from the day that I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day. I've been moving from place to place with a tent as my dwelling. Wherever I have moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of the rulers whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, why have you not built me a house of cedar? God came to Nathan that night and said, you may have said it's okay, but I didn't. Okay? It was wrong for Nathan to answer himself. He's not to answer for himself. He's to answer for God. And if he needs to inquire of God. So God had not said it was okay. So why wasn't it? Why couldn't David build a temple to God? I mean, what's the big deal? 1 Chronicles 22, verse 7. This is David kind of giving some parting comments to Solomon. David says to Solomon, my son, I had it in my heart to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, but this word of the Lord came to me. God told me, you have shed much blood and have fought many wars. You are not to build a house for my name because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight. But you will have a son who will be a man of peace and rest, and I'll give him rest from all of his enemies on every side. His name will be Solomon, and I will grant Israel peace and quiet during his reign. He's the one who will build my house for my name. He will be my son, I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Okay? Why wasn't David able to build the temple? Well, because he had shed much blood, and God had a plan for Solomon to build the temple, a man of peace. Solomon's name even meant peace, shalom. How did God respond, though, to David's request with a blessing? David wanted to build a temple and build a home for God, but God wouldn't let him. But God says no on a positive note. Back to 2 Samuel 7, start at the second half, verse 11. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. Okay, instead of you building a house for me, I'll build a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I'll be his father, and he'll be my son. When he does wrong, I'll punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men, but my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Okay? So he promised an eternal dynasty, that his dynasty would go on forever. And what you also see in here is the promise of a Messiah, the promise of sending the Savior, the promise of Jesus, that Jesus' kingdom would be established forever. Okay? How did David respond to God's rejection? Verse 18. Then King David went in and sat before the Lord, and he said, who am I, O sovereign Lord? And what's my family that you've brought me this far? You know, I'm just nobody. I'm just a shepherd boy from Bethlehem. And as if this weren't enough in your sight, O sovereign Lord, you've also spoken about the future of the house of your servant. Is this your usual way of dealing with man, O sovereign Lord? What more can David say to you? For you know your servant, O sovereign Lord. For the sake of your word and according to your will, you've made done this great thing, and you've made it known to your servant. How great you are, O sovereign Lord. There's none like you, and there's no God but you, as we've heard it with our own ears. Okay, so he praises God. And he goes on in this great prayer that finishes up the chapter 7. He gives this great prayer to God, praising and thanking God for his promises and for his many blessings and the love that he's poured out on David and is showing David and his family. Okay? Now, God had made this promise to David of a kingdom that would endure forever. How did God fulfill that promise? You can go to Luke chapter 1 and see this here. And this is the angel talking to Mary. He says, "You will be with child and give birth to a son, and you're to give him the name Jesus," which is the same name that Jesus is Greek. The Hebrew word is Joshua, okay? And it means the Lord saves. He will be the Savior, okay? Verse 32, "He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never end." So just as God promised that David would have a descendant on the throne forever, he does. And it's not just the throne of David, it's the throne of Israel, it's the throne of the Israelites who are faithful to God, the new Israel. We are descendants of Abraham if we live in the faith of Abraham. Paul describes that in Galatians. And God has placed Jesus as king over all, king over the earth, king over all of his creation forever. Let's pray. God our Father, we thank and praise you for your faithfulness to your promises in making David king. We thank you for the example of faithfulness in David, that he trusted you to fulfill your promises to him. He did not take matters into his own hands, even though he had many opportunities to do so. He looked to you for guidance. He always inquired of you, even when the situation seemed obvious on how to react. And he serves as a great example for us on how to live as faithful children of you. We thank and praise you for fulfilling your promise to David and keeping a king on the throne forever, your son Jesus Christ, who brought salvation to the world and saves us all from the death, eternal death, that we all deserve. We pray this in his name. Amen.